Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, something a little unusual. It's my very last week as host of the podcast, so we're going to invite in some of our great contributors who've enriched this podcast over the years, and then also talk about the evolution of the show.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Well, it may be the end of me, but it's not the end of the podcast. And my brilliant successor, Pamela Paul, will not only be editing the book review, but also will be the host every week. So, Pamela, you had a question for me. You were a little surprised by the approach I've taken. You thought it was going to be sort of more nostalgic or something.
I was waiting for you to reminisce.
Okay, here's what occurred to me, is that the best way to kind of review all these years is to bring in some of the great people who were part of the podcast, and that's why our listeners are going to get to hear from some of them. But first, tell me, and tell our listeners, just how experienced you are in media. It's not like you've never done this sort of thing before.
I have done media. I have usually been on the other side of the microphone, but my first media experience was actually with the Today Show back in 2002 when my first book came out. So I just started small.
Well, tell us what the book was, because it became, you coined a term that is now, part of the conversation.
The first book was The Starter Marriage and the Future of Matrimony. And yes, I was very excited that year, Time Magazine, in their year-end issue, in the Man of the Year issue, did a thing on the new phrases of the time. And one was The Starter Marriage, and another one was To Google.
So
that makes me feel historical.
Oh, yeah, but here's something even more impressive to my mind, and I bet to some of our listeners, too. You've done Oprah, right?
I have done Oprah. I have been in the presence. And I would say that Oprah is up there with Clinton in terms of just emanating waves of charisma. I thought that although I was in the studio with the entire audience and with several other guests, that Oprah and I were really alone. And we were best friends for about 5 minutes.
And what were you best friends about? What was it? Was that also The Starter Marriage or another book?
That was The Starter Marriage. And all I can say is that for about 5 minutes in my head, Oprah and I were best friends and the rest of the audience wasn't there.
You went out to Chicago to do this?
I did.
You were in the studio?
I did. And I was convinced that Oprah would come up to me afterwards and thank me and ask me to lunch and, my life would change.
But that didn't happen.
It didn't happen. She walked right by me.
That's one of the most interesting things about all kinds of media, though we do it a little differently here at the podcast. But something that always comes as a surprise if one does television, I've done some TV too, is your interaction with the host or interviewer is strictly the thing that's being recorded or taped. Now, you hear about how Jon Stewart or someone, I've not done that program, will drop by the green room for 30 seconds or something like that. But even when you do one of these MSNBC programs, and I've done a number of them, no, you don't talk to anybody. You're not part of a family. You go on the set, and that's where it happens. And so it is kind of a surprise, isn't it? Because your friends or family watch and think, wow, so Pamela's now part of Oprah's circle.
Yes, that's right.
But here we are a little more familiar, don't you think? I mean, people come in and they sign our wall. The fiction writers sign the wall we have. And we schmooze a lot here.
And you have your regular contributors.
Yes, that does make a difference. And our listeners will hear from them as well. When you look ahead, I don't mean to put you on the spot at all, but are you thinking already about maybe some embellishments you'll add to the podcast or not yet?
You mean our band?
Our band, yes.
No, I am just hoping to hold up the standard.
And I can give you little bits of advice that you probably don't need. One is that you're really the surrogate for the listener, and it's okay if you ask a question of an author who says, well, no, that's not what I said. And I used to think now all the listeners have discovered what they could have figured out anywhere with a little work is, I don't know what I'm talking about. And I thought, you know what? It makes for good radio. because the author then goes on to say what he or she really did mean in the book or in the short story or the work of fiction. And it's okay if you don't know everything when you're talking to them, because listeners don't know all this stuff either.
That's right. Well, I, you know, in my own experience in coming in as a reviewee and doing the podcast with you, I will say that one of the most disconcerting things is to when you walk in, and when I would walk in and come to your office, Sam, you would often give me a copy of the book review, and it would be the very first time I'd see my book reviewed. And then you would say, come on. And we'd go and we'd record. And all I wanted to do was be alone with that book review, either, you know, weeping or cheering or but I would have no idea what it said.
Oh, you wouldn't read it first?
No, there was never time.
Oh, see, because different people have different approaches. What I do now, if it's an author whose book is being reviewy, as you've said, we sit them in my office and I go out. And they're often with a publicist or editor who's
ever come
along.
And then you come back with tissues.
Well, no, we don't invite people in if we're hammering their books. But then what it does is it kind of psychs them up. The first experience I had different from that was a very famous, esteemed critic in New York, Joan Acacella, the great dance critic for The New Yorker and also book critic. And she came in and she said, no, I'm not going to read the review until after I do the podcast. And I thought, well, that's tremendous discipline that she doesn't want her mind cluttered at all. About
that's the actor's way.
Yeah, and that was your preference too. Or you said I didn't give you enough time.
I didn't have the choice. But well, I'll turn the tables on you, Sam. Who was the best? Who have been the best people you've interviewed on the podcast here?
Well, talk about putting someone on the spot, because we've had a lot of really great guests. One performance, and I'll call it that, that made a huge impression on me was one by the, again, famous critic Francine Prose, was discussing fiction by a remarkable Dutch author who died at the age of 100, and some of his early kind of oblique novels about the Holocaust, or really about the rise of Nazism, had been reissued. And when Francine Prose came in, she discussed those works of fiction, novella and short stories, I think, in a way that made you want to read them. She captured the drama of what the fiction does, which is really rare. It's very difficult to talk about fiction because it's all made up. And so that was really memorable. We did a very, very long podcast. I think it was an hour and a half with Tom Wolfe at the very beginning of all this. I'll tell you two of my regrets. We did video interviews with two major novelists, the late, much lamented John Updike, shortly before he died, and John Irving. You know, these two very famous and accomplished novelists. I forgot or neglected to do was ask them to sign our wall. So John Updike's signature should be on our wall, and John Irving's too. And maybe we'll get John Irving the next time around, but Updike it will never happen. And in those days, what we would do, and we still do, we don't do so many video interviews nowadays. And I have a feeling you'll be starting those up again. We'll discuss that in a second. But we would take the video interview and then repurpose it. Jocelyn would edit it. And so it would be both a podcast and a video interview. But you've done some video interviews while you've been here at the paper. You did a great one on Babar. And you also did Jane Goodall.
Jane Goodall. I mean, it was fantastic. There were two picture books about her that came out a couple years ago, and the illustrators came in and Jane came in, and there again you just feel like you're in the presence of goodness, and she's just a remarkable woman. And also Laurent de Brunhoff, who has written many Babar books, the successor to his father, in that case went up to his studio and he drew a Babar reading the New York Times.
Oh, it was fantastic. Now, are we looking at more? Are you looking to do more?
Definitely,
video?
Yes. And we did a couple at the end of last year. I was thrilled to interview Marlo Thomas on the occasion of the anniversary of Free to Be You and Me, a book and album that was of great importance in my own childhood. So, yes, that's definitely something that we will continue to expand.
Well, I know you have to run, Pamela, but it's a pleasure to be handing this wonderful franchise over to you, along with a copy of the Plain English Brochure that announced us, really Jocelyn, as the winners in the podcast division. It's a British publication.
Sam, and I know you were the winner. You were the winner.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Coolidge by Amity Schlaes, an eye-opening biography of the little-known president behind the 1920s era of growth and national optimism. That's Coolidge, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Hey! That sound you heard was the cork popping on the champagne. Julie Bosman is back. Welcome.
Thank you.
How long has it been, Julie? You're on maternity leave.
It's been 6 months. I left in October and just got back this week.
So, Julie, here you are back in the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the Pulitzers coming along, right?
Just in time.
When are they?
The Pulitzers are going to be announced this coming Monday at 3 o'clock New York time, although much of the publishing world will be in London. So they'll be finishing dinner and half drunk because the London Book Fair starts on Monday.
And the London Book Fair is kind of a big deal now, right? I mean, it's not the Frankfurt Book Fair, but it's a pretty big deal.
I think so. It is a big deal. I think a lot of deals get done, but you know, it's probably not as big as it used to be in previous years, but it still commands a certain amount of attention.
Now let's look ahead a little bit to the Pulitzers. Are there any big books that are being talked about as contenders? One imagines Robert Caro's latest installment in the Lyndon Johnson biography. Anything else we're hearing about?
Well, I think what's interesting this year is that, as you recall, in 2012, the Pulitzer Board did not pick a winner in fiction, which, of course, made the entire book world furious and bewildered, and the wonderful Ann Patchett wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about it. And I think the result of that is going to be that this year everyone will be watching a little bit more closely to see what the Pulitzer Board does pick in the fiction category.
And Julie, remind me and our listeners, did the board explain why they did not choose a book last year? Did they say that none of the contenders were worthy?
They did not say that. Here's what they said. Now, the process is very secretive, but what we do know is that there are three people who are on the fiction jury, and they read many, many books. They winnow the books down to three selections. And then they hand off those selections to the Pulitzer Board, which is made up of a lot of people who are journalists and not necessarily in the publishing world. And then they pick one. They must come to a consensus about that one book.
And we know where consensus stands in our culture right now.
Yes. So this year, and it's happened something like 10 times in history, but in 2012, they did not pick a winner. And they stressed that it was not because none of the books were worthy, but simply because, you know, the board did not come to a consensus decision. So it could have been that the board members all felt so strongly about a certain book that they were unwilling to budge and unwilling to vote for a different title.
So this was kind of the literary equivalent of, oh, the debt ceiling crisis. Now, what about some big novels that came out this past year?
So this past year, it's a little bit of a free-for-all. I think that you certainly have some books that are not eligible. Among them, you have Zadie Smith had a big novel last year, Alice Munro, Hilary Mantel. All of those writers are either British or Canadian, and therefore they are not eligible for the Pulitzer Prize, which is a distinctly American thing.
So this is sort of the literary equivalent of the immigration battle that's going on. Citizenship, the path to citizenship is not open to them.
Exactly. So, you know, there are a lot of books that were really big sellers last year that don't seem quite ambitious enough to be Pulitzer contenders. Some of these books were a few of my personal favorites. Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter, Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, The Chaperone. You know, some of these books were wonderful reads, you know, ambitious in their own way, but almost a little bit too down market for the Pulitzers. So I think what we're left with is a pretty wide open, a wide open race. I mean, a lot of books that landed on, you know, top 10 lists, top 100 lists in 2012. Kevin Powers, his Iraq novel, The Yellow Birds. Louise Erdrich with The Roundhouse, which won the National Book Award.
Juno Diaz's short story.
Juno Diaz, This Is How You Lose Her. He would be a repeat winner if he won for that. So that would be surprising, I think. But it was certainly one of the biggest books of last year. Nathan Englander also had a short story collection.
Really fine short story collection, I thought.
Very good. Michael Chabon had a big novel. Dave Eggers. You know, Nell Freudenberger had a big book last year. So, you know, there are a lot of contenders, but I think that there isn't an obvious winner and there isn't really an obvious shortlist, which makes it even more interesting. I mean, you could even say that Chris Ware, with his collection of graphic novels, Building Stories,
which was one of our 10 best books of the year.
It was. You know, that would be an incredibly thrilling choice if the Pulitzer board were to pick that. So it's interesting. I think that you never really know. It's not like with the bookers where there's a long list and then a short list and, you know which books are contenders. This is going to be a pretty wide open race. And, you know, 2012 was kind of a year for fiction that, you know, didn't have a lot of massive books.
Thanks so much, Julie, and welcome back.
Thank you, Sam.
Let me introduce or reintroduce listeners to two guys who were so instrumental in getting this podcast going. First, Mick Sussman, who was our web producer way back when, and we'll talk about that a little bit, and also Blake Wilson. Both of them are huge stars at the paper now. And are we claiming it's because they were involved in this podcast? No way. That's for others to say. It's others to make the case that if Mick Sussman hadn't had some small part in this podcast, or Blake done the producing, met all the famous people he did in what we call our green room, that they wouldn't have the big careers they do now. But that's not the case I'm ever going to make. Instead, I'm going to welcome these guys. Greetings, both of you.
Good to be here.
Hello, Sam.
Okay, Mick, let's go back to the very beginning. 2005, we started this. And at that point, you were our web producer in this period when, for the first time, the paper was integrating digital and print journalism. When Mick was our web producer, as he was when I started, he didn't even work in the same building as the rest of us. How important was it for all of you? You were like on 37th or 38th Street or something, just to sit with us and be, you know, part of the operation.
It did make a difference, and I was it was still kind of thrilling for me to, you know, pop in on the meetings. And that was part of what sort of inspired some of our early thoughts on the podcast, was just that it was exciting to hear everyone talk about books, all you smart book review editors.
And so, well, you know, it's interesting you say book review editors, because initially that's what we did. It was kind of a garage bandy sort of thing, and it would be editors and copy editors would come in and into my office. We had one microphone we passed around.
Yeah.
And, oh, by the way, how are those I have a private chef. How are those hors d'oeuvres coming along? We're good. Okay.
We are sitting here in a sort of quasi-soundproof studio, which is very impressive. It was, you know, it was literally me with a recorder, you know, and we sort of didn't exactly steal our theme music, but we asked the permission of a punk band who did remember our original theme song?
About listening to the New York Times Book Review.
I read it in the New York Times Book
Review. I read it in the New York Times Book Review. I remember who discovered that? Dwight Garner. Yeah. It was either his idea or yours to do the podcast in the first place, or maybe the two of you together. I remember very early on, after we'd done a few of the podcasts, Mick just happened to play one of the recordings on his computer. And in those days, I would actually prepare a script. Initially, the very first time we did it, I wrote like an old-fashioned radio script for Rachel Donadio and me. And Rachel was then did the first kind of notes from the field that then Motoko Rich and Julie Bosman, Leslie Kaufman carried on. And I wrote out I wrote a fairly elaborate script. It was like 8 or 10 pages with exchanged one-liners. I mean, it was atrocious. It was horrible. But even after we were discouraged from doing that and told by radio people at the Times instead to make a conversation, just have a conversation, I would write out my introductory remarks. And Mick just happened to be playing one of the early recordings, and I heard this thing that any professional would have known, which is that every time I read, my voice flattened out. And I sounded even worse than I do in normal conversation. It was my normal, like, what some charitably called distinctive voice, but without any of the ups and downs, the tonal changes, the interrogative sort of flourishes at the end and all this stuff. It was very flat sounding. And that's when we did away with the script. So that's one big thing I remember. Another is, I bet you won't remember the particular occasion, but at one point you came to me and said, a publisher had asked if an author could be interviewed on the podcast. Do you remember that?
My recollection was our first author was Gary Steingart, or he was early on.
He was very early on, but we approached him because I remember really well when Dwight Garner, and tell this all the time, tell this anecdote glorifying it. Dwight sent a note to Steingart, who's not the novel he'd written about Russia, something Stan, Absurdistan, and asked him, he said, would you like to come in and do the podcast? And Steingart said, yes, or at least learn what one is. We even knew the term at that point, right? But we brought him in. There was somebody in publishing, I think, actually sent you a note, said, because young people in publishing were following it a little bit. It would make sense because they would read the book review on the website, and they saw that we had a podcast. And so they had one of them very sensibly but also entrepreneurially had the idea that they should send an author by, and then it became more of a regular thing. Remember Ian McEwan?
That was another fine one.
He was brilliant. And that was actually when I learned the difference between oral spoken journalism and written journalism. Several of us interviewed Ian McEwan at once, and this is, master of modern fiction, one of the handful of truly great living novelists. And we're very excited to have him. And he came in, and he was jet-lagged because he traveled from London the day before. And he was very brilliant. And he talked about literature and science and history and philosophy,
yeah,
all these areas.
Neuroscience journal entries and things like that.
That's right, the Darwinian debates and all the rest. And it was after his novella on Chesil Beach had published, and Jonathan Lethem had reviewed it for us. And we were dazzled by him. Three of us interviewed him at once. Dwight Garner, Bob Harris, and the deputy and I interviewed him at once. And then we were told by whoever was before the great Jocelyn started, when the podcast went through many channels, superior channels, superiors who would edit things out, and they were utterly bored by McEwan. So it's too insider.
I reject that.
And Mick, I should say, tell us exactly what your title is, because it's scarifying.
That sounds more impressive than, assistant day editor. Yeah, I sort of help oversee the homepage.
Yeah, that's like a huge job at the paper. Why does that sound more impressive than it is? And then his successor is Blake Wilson. And Blake, tell us what you do now. You're also a big shot at the paper.
I'm the deputy editor for the Sunday Metropolitan section.
Right, and kind of celebrated internally for having made the leap from coming in as a digital journalist. You're really doing the print paper now, and that's something you wanted to do. That was in your plans all along, or it just developed?
I mean, it's the way that it worked out. There's not really as much of a distinction between the print paper and the online report these days as there used to be. I mean, when we have a big idea for a major story from the very first story conference. You're talking about what is this going to look like on the web? What is it going to look like on mobile? Is there a social media component? And so the kind of siloing we used to have is, I think, a little bit less relevant today.
But Blake, by the time you were producing or booking for the podcast, you started, what, 2007 or 2008?
Late 2007, I believe.
So at that point, you had pretty regular contact with publishers who would send authors your way.
Yeah, there was already a great deal of receptiveness when I would send out an email or make a call to a publicist saying, hey, you know, would this author, and sometimes very big authors, like to come in? And then over the course of the next 3 or 4 years, more and more people were soliciting us directly. And, you know, we found that we could get real literary greats in here. We interviewed John Updike, Tom Wolfe, Toni Morrison, Alice Munro, and that was great. And I think that was really it was great for listeners. It was great for the New York Times. But what was really great for you, Sam, is when you realized that through memoirs, there was sort of a backdoor way for you to get celebrities in here. We brought in Patti Smith, who, I mean, her book, Just Kids, is more than a celebrity memoir. I mean, it's a really consequential work of
And what
nonfiction.
Was it the National Book Award or the National Book Critics Circle that it won?
I think it was the National Book Award.
Yeah, I think it was.
We spoke to Keith Richards on the telephone.
Never forget that moment. He was in Connecticut on the phone waiting to hear from me.
And, you know, some of your personal heroes, Jay McInerney, Henry Kissinger.
Rob Lowe. It takes us. Rob Lowe came into my office to do that. And the young people who work at Ernst & Young, here we are, we're being surveyed by the accountants who are going to take us all to ruin, lined up to get his autograph. And in IQ terms, the smartest person who's ever been at the book review, who's going to be out behind a microphone soon, Jenny Schuessler, who's now the culture reporter for the Times, ideas reporter, was so dazzled by Rob Lowe that she would not go up and speak to him. But yeah, that's right. We got a lot of cool celebrities. And when I walked Patti Smith to the newsroom, because sometimes we would do that, when a really well-known person came in, I would introduce them to Bill Keller and Jill Abramson, who were the top editors then, and walk them through the newsroom. When we walked Patti Smith through, people were jumping out of their cubicles to introduce themselves to her.
Well, the strongest reaction we ever got from our, you know, august, serious intellectual colleagues, the one guest we brought in that just had people knocking down the walls to get autographs signed. Do you remember?
Hulk Hogan?
Hulk Hogan.
And I didn't even interview him. Dave Itzkoff did. Remember? I was intimidated.
Running into you and Hulk Hogan in the New York Times elevator was one of the more surreal moments.
You needed a bigger guy than you to take on Hulk Hogan.
So we went to Dave. Yeah. We went to Dave Itzkoff. Yeah. Well, listen, it was really great to have both of you guys involved and help this thing getting off the ground. Thank you, Mick, and thank you, Blake.
Bye, Sam.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Two really familiar voices are with us now, and two of the real stars of the podcast. Motoko Rich was our Notes from the Field reporter when she had the publishing beat. Welcome, Motoko.
Thank you, Sam.
She's now, you see a byline in the paper almost every day. And the same is true of Jennifer Schuessler, who did the bestseller column and then also did the report on it. Now, we call you the Ideas Reporter, or are you just a culture reporter?
I think so.
So, Motoko, tell us about where publishing was when you were first reporting. Wasn't it kind of the birth of reading on devices? That was kind of your
topic.
Yes,
it was kind of incredible that when I first took on the beat, there were no e-readers, or there were very few e-readers.
So tell us when this was, Motoko.
This would have been 2006. And then I went on maternity leave and came back in 2007.
So the devices were the news.
Yes, devices were news, things going online. And one of the early stories I did actually was about the demise of book reviews and how more and more book reviewing was happening on blogs. That was when, it wasn't Richard Price, but it was Richard Ford who gave the famous quote about he didn't care what some blogger in Terre Haute had to say about his book. And then I had a report about the sort of continuing incursion of the digital world into publishing, and that, you know, moved from what was happening online on the internet to the devices. And I was sort of at the beginning of reporting of, you know, when the Kindle came out, I was at their first press conference and all the fights over e-rights.
You were at the first press conference?
For
that
Kindle.
Amazon's?
For Amazon's press conference. Kindle, yeah.
And you were pretty early on kind of testing like even a BlackBerry or iPhone as a means of reading to your kids, weren't you?
A couple of times, yeah. I mean, I was probably actually a bit of a late adopter because being on the BookSpeed, you got all these free books. And I also wanted to sort of see how agnostic one could remain. But obviously now I read on all different kinds of devices. It is actually interesting. I read on my iPad. I have a Kindle. I read on my iPhone. We all do.
Let me ask you something else, Motoko. You also did profiles. I remember one in particular of Laurie Moore, the great fiction writer. How much of the beat when you covered it became less about literary life and more about sort of the threatened industry of publishing or the changing industry?
I think that's a really good way of characterizing the transition that happened when I was on my watch. It seemed like before there was a lot about literary life and scandals, and there were a fair number of scandals on my
feed. Remind us some of the scandals.
Well, there was the woman who had written a memoir about having been fostered by an African American family. She was a white woman who had been fostered by an African American family in
Margaret Jones.
Yes, there we go. And it turned out it was all fake, that she had grown up in the lap of, you know, suburban relative affluence in Orange County. So that was one of the big ones that broke. 2 or 3 days onto my taking over the BookSpeed, both Denisha Smith and I covered the Kavya Viswanathan scandal, when the young Harvard student had plagiarized another young adult author gotten a very large advance for her book from Little Brown.
And Motoko, what about the sort of decline of Borders and Barnes & Noble that you covered that summer? Or was that really more Julie?
I think that was really more Julie. But to go back to your original question, which was about the transition from covering literary life to covering the demise of the industry, there was definitely a lot of that tension. I mean, I got to go to Frankfurt and follow around Lauren and Anna Stein, which was very much the literary life. But it almost felt like fin de siècle, the last of this sort of lifestyle and moving. And then the stories became much more and more about Google and Amazon and Kindle and the publishers fighting over their rights and their survival.
Jenny, you've switched. You've kind of gone from low to high. I mean, Jenny is about as highbrow as anybody could be. Book Review, remind us again how many years you worked at the New York Review of Books.
10 years and a few months.
10 years and a few months. You went from there. You were the editor of the Boston Globe Ideas section. I mean, that's very serious journalism. But you loved writing our bestseller column.
I loved it. And Sam, I'm sorry, for old time's sake, I have to ask you, what's new on the list this week? Because I have no idea. I'm spending all my time with historians, economists, sociologists, fun party animals like that.
But you have a kind of high-low gene, right? You do enjoy mixing the two, right?
I think so, yeah. But what I like to say is, once you've been writing about the bestseller list exploits of Glenn Beck, James Patterson, Jen Wiener, all of whom I assume have already phoned in their congratulations to you, Sam, and their goodbyes and perhaps good riddances, there's nowhere to go but down.
Well, you know, Jenny did something that no one else at the Book Review was ever able to do, including me. Jenny is a tremendous wit, but she really does like a script, and you would come in with a script, but she got so good nobody ever could tell you were reading it.
Not reading word for word. I just wrote out your question, Sam, because I had to keep you on script. I had to keep you on script.
You wrote out the questions for me. But you always had a little riff you worked. And was that something that you had arrived at through forethought, or it would just pop?
A little bit. Yeah. Well, I had already written the column, so I just kind of blabbed. And I had a lot of other things to say. And I have to say, too, talking is so much easier than writing.
You know who else told me that?
Sam always said that.
Yes, and you know who I got it from was A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, when he was doing actually the program with Roger Ebert. Remember, for a period of time, Tony Scott, our great film critic here, one of our great film critics, flew out to Chicago to do the program with the late Roger Ebert. And I complimented him on it once. Tony's also really good on those little video spots he does. And now he does a sweet spot with David Carr. And he's, you know, very amusing and clever and quick-witted. And he said, talking's easier than writing, which is true. And something we all had to learn is to speak more slowly in the podcast. Do you remember that? Because we are word people, it tends to come rushing out of us. And I remember Jocelyn telling me once, because we got training from the head of WQXR when the Times still owned that station. We all got residuals when those programs ran. We made a little money. Jocelyn, he told us to slow down. He taught us all these little tricks of radio broadcasting, which made me and I think others realize that it is its own form of journalism. You do it in a different way, but it has its own discipline, and some people are better at it than others. But he told us we all had to slow down. We never imposed that rule on guests because they were self-conscious enough coming in once. But regulars, remember we belonged to AFTRA at one point, had our union dues paid. And Jocelyn at one point said, if you think you're speaking too slowly, you're still talking too fast.
Mm. I did get a fan email, of which I'm very proud, from a reader in Brazil who said that although Mutoko Rich speaks very quickly, she is easy to understand.
Have you read any of the reviews of Jenny Schuessler's voice on the iTunes store?
Are you serious?
I'm so serious.
What are the reviews? What do they say?
There's definitely been remarks about how sexy Jenny sounds.
Wow. Whoa, the only fan letter I ever got is after the podcast saying that I was leaving, and it was this guy in Devon in England who said that he liked to listen to me while I was milking the cows.
Oh, my
gosh.
It's a double meaning there.
If not a triple. That's going to get edited out. Oh, like all my good stuff.
Jenny, when you were doing the bestseller column, we were still in that very kind of fraught ideological moment, right? A lot of left.
Is it over?
Well, that's a good question. But it seemed especially fraught then. It really did. Glenn Beck was the dominant figure in media culture, which seems kind of interesting now because one doesn't hear so much about him. But here's a question I think a lot of people had. Why did those lists, nonfiction lists most of the time, seem dominated by conservative writers?
That's actually a really interesting question because, I mean, I think the sort of perception out there, the stereotype, is that the, you know, kind of book-buying public, the sort of college-educated public, whatever you want to call it, is sort of, you know,
liberal.
Like the media itself.
Yeah,
liberal,
right.
You know. But, I mean, it may be, I don't know. And, I mean, one sort of idea I had, and this is completely speculative, is that people who bought those books, I mean, those books were sort of written to be red meat, and I think a lot of those people felt like they were getting a story they weren't getting anywhere else. You know, they weren't getting in, you know, newspapers on television except for Fox News. So there was some kind of motivation. I don't know. I also just think that people on the left don't produce as, you know, on the political, the sort of hard political left, don't produce as many of those sorts of intense polemical books. You know, I mean, you have people like Michael Moore, a few of these, you know, Al Franken had some bestsellers, but you just don't have as many of those kind of media personalities with their own platforms. You know, Bill O'Reilly has his show. Glenn Beck had his shows, you know, so they can promote this stuff. I don't know.
Do you still follow the bestseller list,
Jenny? I do. Not as closely. But, yeah, I mean, when you mentioned Glenn Beck, one thing that was really fascinating, I know Mutoko wrote about this, you know, as a reporter, was the role he played not just as a writer but as a tastemaker. And right. The thing I was perpetually really fascinated by, partly because it gave me kind of interesting previously obscure books to write about instead of the same stuff on the list week after week, is how he would sort of, you know, he endorsed lots of these thrillers, these kind of techno thriller type books, and then he sort of kind of started going really off the reservation.
The
and,
Christmas,
you know,
stories.
Yeah,
that he wrote.
Yeah, he wrote, but he did this whole, I think, 2-part special about Friedrich von Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. You know, kind of classic text of, you know, free market economics, and that, you know, ended up, I think University of Chicago could not, it was a sort of a good perennial
seller
for them.
They couldn't keep copies in bookstores.
Hundreds of thousands of copies. You know, he started talking about a book called A Patriot's History of the United States by two historians, which was sort of intended as a corrective to Howard Zinn. I think they ended up selling something
like 300,000 copies. So this was a conservative account of American history.
But then he,
you know, ranted, I shouldn't be using such words, but he sort of denounced on his show this really obscure book published by Semiotext, this sort of French semiotic publisher called The Invisible Threat or something like that. But it was basically this anarchist text written by this anonymous French anarchist collective. And Glenn Beck, you know, held this up and denounced it. And that thing sold, you know, 20,000 copies. I don't know to who, but it was just kind of fascinating to see this guy who he would just kind of shine his light on something and the stuff would go flying out the
door. Well, the tastemaker question has always been fascinating. One of the first stories I did on the beat was when Hugo Chavez stood up at the UN and held up Noam Chomsky's book.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And it did spike in sales. So everybody wanted a seat on Oprah's couch, but there were, in fact, quite a few people who could make a book go to the top of our bestseller list.
Tell us about the beat you're covering now.
So now I'm covering K-12 education, which is a bit of a full circle beat for me that I'm, in fact, talking to a lot of the same people that I talked to when I was covering books.
Well, that was going to be my question. Yeah, how useful. I mean, a lot of great reporters at the Times, and everybody said it's not the biggest beat at the paper to do publishing, but it's kind of like a boutique.
It's a jewel.
Fun thing, right?
You go to Gold Park. It's one of the best beats at the
paper. What?
Partly it's just fun. If you are a person that loves books, it's fun to sort of pull back the curtain and see what goes on behind Oz. But also, like you said, it comes in usefully in many other ways. I mean, books are written about all kinds of subjects. So when I was on the economics beat, it was very helpful to know who the publishers were and to be up on what books were being written about economics. But now, I mean, my beat, half of what I write about is about reading. I mean, it's so incredibly important to education because I'm writing about K-12 education that people are talking about it constantly.
Is it still the backbone of education is just being able to read, interpret, and analyze?
It's one of the really key backbones. And it is one of the things that educators are talking increasingly about with this new Common Core, which is a set of curriculum standards that have been adopted by 46 states. And they talk a lot about we need to have a nation, a really literate nation of readers who can read carefully and closely. And so all the publishers are scrambling to try to keep up with that and market themselves as part of this Common Core. But I also wrote a story about how there weren't enough books for kids, early readers, with Latino characters. And that had a lot of resonance. I got tons and tons of email and response about that. So, and certainly it was helpful that I had covered the books business to sort of just know who the key players were and to be able to sort of look at it from the publishing side as well as the education side.
Thanks so much to both of you. It's
Thanks,
been a great
Sam.
Run.
Sam.
And remember, Good Pamela luck. Will be here. You do stuff for her.
I will
and,
be tuning in.
Yeah, it was really, really had a great run. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Good night and good luck.
I'm Sam Tannenhaus, and this is Inside the New York Times Book Review.
All right, now our current web producer, John Williams, joins us. Hey, John.
Hi, Sam.
So when you joined us, which was how long ago now?
About a year and a half ago.
The podcast was already pretty much kind of as smoothly an operating thing as it ever had been. What surprised you about it when you came here?
You know, you knock it out pretty quickly. There's not, you know, Jocelyn does a great job editing, but at the same time, you sort of get a lot of interesting stuff on the first take with people, and you record the episode, you know, within this sort of 1 to 2 hour window every week. And it surprised me that it was so efficient, I think.
And what about the booking side of it? Did you find big name authors and major publishers were normally fairly cooperative, would like to send their people over?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a big benefit to being at a place like the Times and also having the well-established audience and people enjoy talking to you. So all those things combine to really, if people can do it, they will. There are occasions where people are either, you know, overseas or they're way too busy with some other promotional thing that had already been booked somewhere else in the country. But by and large, if people are here or can get to a phone, they're going to do the show, which is great.
Now, something that's interesting and really helpful in your employment history, your career is you've actually worked in publishing.
Yeah, I was at HarperCollins for 6 years as an editor, first assisting an executive editor there, and then as a paperback editor myself.
So, and you also were the originator of a quite closely read and admired blog.
Oh, thanks.
Second
Sam.
Pass.
Second Pass. Yeah.
And how did that come about?
It just came about through my own I had been working in some other publishing-related jobs after leaving HarperCollins but wanted to do some more of my own writing and editing. And so I just sort of started it from scratch with the help of a couple of design friends, but editorially I just reached out to people who I thought might want to contribute and did most of the writing on the blog myself and some reviewing of books new and old myself. So it was sort of a one-man operation, but with help from a lot of different people along the way.
So were you conscious? I mean, you make the leap from doing that to the New York Times, and you really do have to give up this blog. It's just the way we operate, right. And it made sense at the time. But any regret that this thing you'd created is now more or less not in your life anymore?
A little bit. Not enough to – I really love my job here, so not enough to make me regret it entirely. But there are moments where I'll want to write about something that's completely obscure or weird that, you know, the Times wouldn't be interested in at all. And I used to have this place where I could just kind of dump it, and now I don't. And that makes me a little sad. And, you know, it had gotten after only being up for a couple of years, it had been noticed by some people. And it's always nice to have something you've kind of created from the ground up get noticed. And so it's a different – obviously kind of satisfaction being at a place like the Times where you're just noticed for built-in reasons.
And what about making the move? You're one of a number of people who've done it, and actually some quite big names, making the move really from the world of publishing to the world, not just of journalism, but of a newspaper, which is, you know, the fastest moving, really, of the old media, as we call it. Someone who came out of book publishing is David Shipley, you know, who now runs Bloomberg Views and was the op-ed editor at the New York Times. And some people just are kind of naturally gravitate toward journalism. Were you aware when you started your blog that that's where you were headed, or was all this kind of a surprise that suddenly you're a newspaper guy?
A little bit. I mean, you know, I didn't expect to end up at the Times necessarily, but I did think that either in online journalism or traditional newspapers or magazines, that was kind of where I was headed or where I wanted to be headed rather than the traditional book world. I mean, publishing.
Why? Was it too slow? Book publishing too slow?
It was a little slow. I had started in newspaper jobs right out of college.
Oh,
you
had?
I was a sports reporter down in Texas for a few really small newspapers down there, and then I freelanced for the Dallas Morning News for a while. Yeah, I do like the daily pace or the weekly pace a little bit more than, you know, with books sometimes you'll be years out from the day you sign a book to the day that it hits the bookstores. So book publishing, there are only so many jobs there for editors. There are a lot of young editors who get involved, and then they sort of get spread out to different things. Some of them stay in books, but some of them migrate, I think, because of there are only so many great editing jobs in the book publishing world.
And something our listeners may not grasp, it's not even many in the building really understand it, the New York Times building, is that you really have two different desks and you have two different sets of masters, both the daily art section, culture section, and the book review. And how do you balance the two of them?
Well, I spend a couple of days a week down on the fourth floor, one floor below us, and I work closely down there with Julie Bloom, who's the culture web editor, and Scott Heller, who's the daily books review and theater editor. And it's actually, you know, this place works in a way that makes it fairly easy because it's not a very hierarchical place to begin with. And so, you know, everyone is good about giving me the green light to do certain things. If I have to come up with ideas, but once I do, people tend to be pretty open-minded and encouraging about doing new things, which is nice. And
well, you have a lot of bylines in the paper. You're writing a lot online, but also in print.
Yeah, I've been lucky. Well, you told me very early on when I came here that if once you're in the building, you should take advantage of it and try to do as much as you can because people are open-minded about that. And I found that to be the case. So I've been really lucky.
Well, and John, and just to give our listeners a sense of the versatility we expect, particularly of younger journalists like yourself, we're either – well, I guess we don't have to have John take over the controls so you talk, Jocelyn, right? You can do it from back there.
It's technology.
All right, technology. So all three of us here. Jocelyn just told me an amazing fact, John. I want you to hear this. So repeat it to me, Jocelyn.
So I've been here 5.5, 6 years doing podcasting, and this is one of the shows that I've been doing since I got here. And I was doing a little bit of math. And if I consider that some weeks we actually did double time, I have probably watched you, Sam, do close to like 1,100 interviews.
Wow.
That's really something, you know, when you consider that Mary McCarthy's description of the art historian and critic Meyer Shapiro, a mouth in search of an ear, naturally applies to me that every now and again I'm actually a bit more ear than mouth.
Well,
Who knew?
You had the great line. I don't know if someone's already said it today, but you said you jokingly said, you know, I started out wanting to be Robert Silvers and I turned into Howard Stern.
Yeah. Without the money that either one of those guys has.
Well, here's the thing, though. It's really interesting because I obviously worked on other radio shows before with other hosts, and I know the prep that goes into doing a radio show or a television show. But as John said, we have a pretty quick turnaround here, and no matter who's been in that seat, it doesn't matter what the topic was, monkeys, cars, traffic, big waves, whatever it might have been, you always manage to sound incredibly knowledgeable about the author's book, but at the same time, incredibly open and curious. And I have no idea how you prep for these things so quickly. Can you tell us anything about this?
Oh,
or is
boy.
It bottled up and we can't get it?
I'll answer that anecdotally. When we switched over briefly, it was our kind of moment of glory. I shouldn't say switch over, expanded from being just a podcast to also being a radio program in WQXR. And Jocelyn was involved in that. That was before you joined us, John. We actually had fairly intensive training sessions where Tom Bartunek, who was the program director of, is that the right title,
yeah,
Jocelyn?
So. Yeah.
For WQXR, came in and taught us all sorts of curious tricks of broadcasting. There are very small things not worth getting into. But when we did our first broadcast that we knew was destined as well for WQXR, I violated what I soon discovered was the cardinal rule of interviewing. I closely read the books by the authors we brought in. And you know why that was a mistake? Because I very quickly delved so deeply into the content or the aesthetic or the author's choices, the big themes in their books, that I think listeners got lost. And so what I'm really saying is that, you know, the complaint many authors have, and I've had this complaint myself, oh, you're interviewed by somebody who obviously hasn't read the book. In some ways, that's actually an advantage. Why? Because one is the interviewer the surrogate for the listener.
Right, and you're not taking for granted what the listener, you know, you're not skipping past the essentials. You're getting to the really fundamental parts of the book instead of getting into the weeds, like you said.
Yes, that's exactly right. And as we mentioned this earlier in this marathon podcast, I learned early on not to be embarrassed when I'd completely misconstrued or misunderstood what an author had said, because if they correct me on air and say, well, no, that's not my argument, this is what my argument is, that's okay.
Yeah, it brings more clarity to what they say.
Yeah, it brings more clarity to it, and you're not there to be the genius yourself. So I tell fiction writers, before we begin an interview with a novelist or short story writer, and John and Jocelyn, you know this because you've heard me say it, that assume the listener hasn't read the book and hasn't even read the review we're publishing or any other reviews, and talk about the novel as if it's something that really happened and the characters in it as if they're actual people. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, depending on how the interview goes, we'll get into these fine points of craft and art. But for now, just tell us what the story is. And it's interesting, Jocelyn, you mentioned this once when we after you won the award and I interviewed you, that the fiction writers and guests in general have gotten more accomplished and more comfortable with the medium over the years.
That's true. But I think in the beginning, you have so many personalities coming in through the door. No matter how nervous they are or how like media shiny they were, you've always been able to make them sound comfortable and confident. If they're really, you know, sticking to their press text, you've been able to break them down and sound more conversational. And this is, I think, like really rare when you've listened to as many tracks as I have. And I've always wondered what you're thinking. Do you have, like, how do you steer an interview? Do you know when you have to pull a guest back in? Do you know when they're feeling not so confident about what they're saying, that you should maybe go back and give them another chance to answer a question?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just trying to be in the moment, and that's what this journalism is about. But, you know, Jocelyn, with this broader question, I'll take your word for it that people feel relaxed. For one thing, I'm the world's least intimidating person.
Yet I feel very uncomfortable around you.
Yeah, right. Well, I find, you know, even when I teach courses, you know, I do a lecture course at the New School. After one class, there are 50 kids in the room, they start speaking up. It's you know, it's kind of like, you know, you go to a restaurant or you go to dinner at someone's house and somebody else spills the wine and you think, yes, it wasn't me. And I think people have that view. They see me and they figure no matter how bad they are, they're going to come off sounding better.
But Sam's being modest.
But here are two other things that have stuck with me. But when I wrote the Chambers book was when I first got exposed to some of this. And there was a radio interview I was scheduled to do in Chicago. In those days, one would actually, as some authors do, I have a very abbreviated tour. You would sign books in a bookstore and this kind of thing. And there were a few interviews I was doing there. There was a guy named Milt Rosenberg, I think his name was, who did something at the University of Chicago, interview with him. But one thing, and you would have one of these escorts who would take you around, was to go out to a studio miles outside Chicago and sit in front of a microphone, as I'm doing now, and be interviewed over the phone with someone in Wisconsin, I think it was. And before that happened, we walked along a corridor, and there was a man alone in a booth talking into a microphone. And I was just, in my fantasizing mind, imagining this was some kind of radio, you know, those days had shock jocks and all this, some kind of radio guy. And there was something so lonely about it. Here he is speaking to this audience alone in this microphone. There was something haunting about that. And then I combine that with a second memory I have of when I think I was first interviewed by Leonard Lopate, who's one of the great radio interviewers here in New York. And there was a kind of coziness in being in the booth with him. Even though one wasn't introduced to him before, you were just brought into the small booth, which is actually quite a bit smaller than the area we're in now. And he's across the table with that beautiful melodious voice and this kind of soothing quality. And I remember when he interviewed me, it felt like a kind of New York moment, because I remember when I was much younger and I'd be, you know, in the floor through apartment in Greenpoint, you know, listening to him in the radio. And there was a kind of communal aspect. And it was this dynamic between the loneliness of the radio personality on the one hand and the sense of coziness and communality of the guest that always kind of is in my head somewhere, because you want to create, if possible, or help foster, and certainly not inhibit, an atmosphere of comfort, a kind of bubble of comfort in this area here, in this little studio, that is conveyed to listeners out there. And that's why it's gratifying to hear from them, because they often write people who will send in notes and sometimes criticism. Say, why don't you do this thing instead of that thing? There was one person from Atlanta who was very experienced in media and told me my exits from interviews were awkward, that I would always say thank you to the guest when instead I should say, well, we'll be looking forward to hearing more from you or something like that. And I asked Jocelyn about it, and Jocelyn said, no, just do it the way you do. Right. I say that in part because those listeners who have been in touch and have wondered why I've seemed so grateful for their suggestions but not always acted on them is because in each case I've consulted with you, John, or Jocelyn, anybody involved in it, and we've thought about it and discussed it, said, you know what, it kind of works the way it does. This is how we do it. But it's the sense of the community that really makes it work. And I think, Jocelyn, when authors come in, especially nowadays, they'll be accompanied by a publicist or two or an editor and publicist. And we always invite those other people in, right?
Yeah.
It feels kind of homey.
Yeah. But most of the feedback we get is very positive. And listeners, you know, I filled in a couple of weeks ago for you, and someone wrote on Twitter or somewhere, I'm always sad when Sam Tannenhaus is off on the podcast. And they had no idea that they were looking at a vaster absence going up. They're going to be crushed.
Well,
you've got a real fan base.
Well, if this were video, it wouldn't be a problem, because John is a younger, much better looking version of me who's like 9 inches taller. So if we were doing this on television, people would be glad to see him instead. But that's, you know, that's the joy of radio is that it is all, it's about the voice. I think it's enthusiasm and engagement. And we always feel that there's never been a time, even when I was down or concerned or upset about one thing or another that might be going on in my life or at the book review or the newspaper at large. We've been through some very difficult times here, as we all know, that the podcast didn't pick me up somehow. And I think, you know, maybe that's what we've conveyed a little bit of. Don't you think, Jocelyn? That we really like doing it. We really enjoy it. So one thing I'll miss most. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. First a toast. Champagne toast to Greg.
To Sam.
It has been a good run. Here's my secret ambition, that even though my successor, Pamela Paul, has got this great voice and is a fantastic journalist, that she'll be a total disaster. Nobody will listen anymore, and they'll demand that I do the podcast, but not make me edit the book review any longer. But, Greg, you've got a ton of bestseller news.
Yeah, there are 12 new books on the combined lists this week, on the hardcover fiction and nonfiction lists. So I'll just run them down. Starting at number 16 on the hardcover fiction list, we have a book called Reconstructing Amelia by a woman named Kimberly McCrate. It's her first novel. It's a mystery. A woman whose daughter has purportedly committed suicide at her elite prep school, but the mother thinks, in fact, there may have been foul play involved, and so she's trying to uncover the story there.
That's a pretty good storyline.
It is. You know, she's called to pick her daughter up. The school claims that her daughter is being suspended effective immediately for cheating. And when she arrives at the school, all the emergency services are there. Everyone, the daughter has died at the school. And the story is that she jumped off the roof of the building there. And the distraught mother kind of wants to believe that story, but she gets a text somewhere along the way that says she didn't jump. And it sets her off on this odyssey trying to figure out what really happened.
That's great. What's next?
Then at number 14, a bit of a surprise, James Salter, who was born in 1925, long respected as a writer's writer, has never had a bestseller. But now at age 87, I guess, his new novel, All That Is, has made the list at number 14. It is
his first in 30 years, isn't it? His first work of fiction in 30 years?
No, he's written story collections more recently than that. And he's very famous for a very short novel. All of his writing to this point has been very short. He's famous for a novel, almost a novella, called A Sport and a Pastime that was very much about sex. And not baseball. And sex is kind of a constant theme in his work, including in this novel, which unusually for him is much bigger. It's, you know, almost 300 pages. And it's got this autumnal style to it. James Salter on the fiction list.
Good for him.
Yeah. Then going all the way up to number three, each of the top three spots on this week's fiction list are new to the list this week. Number three, Kate Atkinson, the Scottish mystery writer and really a clever literary novelist, has a new book out called Life After Life. It's kind of a Groundhog Day story where the main character keeps dying. It opens with her dying on the day of her birth, and then she lives a little bit longer the next chapter. And each time she lives a little bit longer, it takes you through. It's kind of set around World War II, around that time. And so it's this very playful, postmodern story of almost like a choose-your-own-adventure path. It explores alternate realities. If she didn't die this day, then, you know, what might her life have been like until she, boom, she dies. And then, well, if she didn't die that way, then what might have happened in her life? And it's like this garden of forking paths. At number two, a guy who broke out quite a while ago, Paulo Coelho, the Brazilian kind of guru novelist who brought us The Alchemist, has a new book called Manuscript Found in Accra, which is not so much a novel as a wisdom book along the lines of like Khalil Gibran, the prophet. This book is set in Jerusalem on the eve of the Crusaders sweeping in, and all the citizens of Jerusalem are anxious and until one man rises up among them and kind of spouts forth a whole collection of really cliched aphorisms, trying to reassure them.
Now, I read your column, Greg, you know, before, and your columns are always quite amazingly word perfect every now and again. I'll stick a comma in just to prove that I am or was the boss.
Thanks, Sam.
But you're not his biggest fan, well, was what I drew from your column. And you made the case in the most, some would say, ungenerous way. You quote him. I can't believe this stuff he writes.
Coelho makes great copy. What I actually quote is a profile from The Guardian in England quoting him. The reporter in The Guardian goes to the book and pulls out some of the cliches that he finds there, including it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, and don't give up, the last key on the ring is always the one that will open the door.
There's a weird kind of genius to doing that.
There is, and what Coelho did here, he has turned to social media in a big way. He's got a ton of Facebook friends, and on Twitter, he's got like 6.3 million followers. And so
6.3 million followers?
6.3 million followers. And so,
if he were living in the United States, let's say, and each one of them swore to vote the way he told them to in an election, he would be like a one-man battleground swing state.
There you go. He put a call out on Twitter asking his followers what made them anxious, what their biggest fears were. And so he, in effect, is the prophet, the Copt, he calls him. And his followers are the citizens of Jerusalem. And he responded to their fears writing this book, kind of marshaling forth. Some of them are really quotes from the Bible. Some of them are quotes from old sources. He's just kind of marshaling, evoking wisdom of the ages.
What language does he write in? He doesn't write in English.
That's funny you should ask that. He writes in Portuguese, as you'd expect for a Brazilian. It's funny you ask because his translator into English for this book is Margaret Joel Costa, and she is really a prominent translator from Spanish and Portuguese. She's translated José Saramago, the Nobel laureate. She's translated Javier Marías, Gabriel García Márquez. In 2009, the literary blog Book Slut did an interview with her about translating. And one of the questions they asked her was, you know, we identify you so much with the people that you choose to translate. And is it important to you that you identify with them and that you kind of share their values, their literary? And she said, oh, absolutely. I could never translate a book I don't like. I really don't have a lot of respect for Paulo Coelho's.
Wait, are you saying I don't want to overinterpret here. It's a big mistake for an interviewer. Are you saying he is not in the same league as García Márquez and Saramago, or am I reading too much?
No, that's a pretty accurate interpretation there. And then new at number one, Debbie McComber, who lives in Washington State and writes a lot of these series novels. They're kind of comfortable romance novels. They often involve knitting. And in fact, Debbie McComber herself owns a yarn store.
Her novels involve knitting?
They do. It's a real theme in her novels. And she truly owns a yarn store called A Good Yarn. She's new at number one with a novel called Starting Now, and it's the latest in her Blossom Street series. Then on the nonfiction side of things, new at number 10, David Sheff, who hit the list several years ago with a memoir called Beautiful Boy that was about his son's crystal meth addiction. He is now new on the list with a book called Clean that is kind of a pop science book looking into the latest research, the latest science on addiction and on shaking addiction. And he looks at psychology and he looks at medicine, he looks at neuroscience. And so it's really kind of a roundup of the latest science on both addiction and rehab. Then at number 8, Maya Angelou, a longtime regular on the list, has a new memoir. It's called Mom and Me and Mom. Just above her on the list at number 7, Debbie Reynolds has her second memoir, Unsinkable. Her first memoir came out 25 years ago, and it visited her marriage to Eddie Fisher and the way that he left her for Elizabeth Taylor and all of that. And it ended on the story that she had now found her new Prince Charming. It was going to be her third marriage. Unsinkable, her second memoir, new at number 7, tells the story of how her third husband took her for everything she had, left her bankrupt, and cheated on her and left her for another woman. So
why am I not utterly surprised by that?
She told, I think it was USA Today, she told somebody in an interview recently that, what can I say? I'm just bad at marriage. I have no knack for picking men. Still more new titles on the list. New at number five, Deborah Perry Piccione has a book called Secrets of Silicon Valley. She is herself an entrepreneur and a media commenter. And this looks at how even in the economic downturn, and of course everybody remembers when the tech bubble burst, that Silicon Valley has righted itself faster than anywhere else in America. Most of the venture capital investments in America take place in Silicon Valley now. And it's kind of this thriving hotbed of innovation. That's where everything's happening economically in America right now.
And I suppose the implicit contrast would be with Wall Street, where it's about investment and what do they call those things? Those, you know, economic instruments and such,
right.
But not really about entrepreneurship or creating ideas. And
right. And this is a book that it's selling well. It also has one of our daggers next to it. So I don't know if it's, you know, being passed out at business conferences.
Well, explain what the dagger means.
Dagger means it represents bulk sales. And so it may be that this is being passed out as kind of an inspirational business story, you know, that she's giving talks and passing them out. But there it is at number five on the list. At number four, David Stockman, the former budget director for Ronald Reagan, who just had an excerpt from this book published as an op-ed in the New York Times that, boom, went right to number one. It's called The Great Deformation or Deformation. And he's going back and looking at economic history. And it's this massive, it's a 700-page book, kind of arguing for a return to the gold standard. And he attacks Republicans, he attacks Democrats, just saying that our financial house is a complete shambles and everything's going to come crashing down. At number three, the mommy blogger Glennon Doyle Melton has a book called Carry On Warrior. She blogs at a website called momastery.com. She's a Christian. She writes about her faith on there. So momastery is kind of a play on monastery. Also maybe a play on mom mastery. She was a former alcoholic and a former bulimic, and she talks about that on the site. She writes these kind of funny personal essays about the challenges of parenting, and she built up an audience there, and so eventually it turned into this book deal and this book, which is now new at number three, Carry On Warrior. And the highest-ranking new title on the nonfiction side of things this week is by our contributor Mary Roach, a pop science writer. Her new book is called Gulp, and it is her exploration of the digestive tract from mouth to anus and kind of everything in between. She looks at saliva. She looks at the intestines and gas buildup. And it's fascinating and disgusting and all of that all at once.
Mary Roach is the most charming person and writer who chooses the most unusual topics.
Yeah, she wrote a previous book called Packing for Mars that was looking at, you know, how space affects the human body. And she had a chapter in there about digestion. And I think that's how she got turned on to this as a topic, thinking it's really fascinating even here on Earth.
I can't believe you just said turned on to that topic. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.